Are you looking for a podcast that your whole family can enjoy that asks the deep philosophical questions like, do trees fart?
If you are, then you'll love Tumble, a science podcast for kids. I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Marshall. Join us as we explore stories of science discovery, from butts to animals, dinosaurs, astronomy, and everything in between.
You'll love these stories, and you'll learn something new.
Find and follow Tumble Science Podcast for Kids wherever you get your podcasts, or at sciencepodcastforkids.com.
Have you ever wished that you had a direct line to your pediatrician to ask all the questions that constantly crop up while parenting? We sure have. That's why we launched the Bites of Health podcast. Every morning, we'll answer a commonly asked pediatric question in 5 minutes or less. You can tune in while you're making your second cup of coffee or from the school drop-off line. So be sure to tune in to Bites of Health, streaming now.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, everybody. It's Mick Sullivan, and this is The Past and the Curious. First off, I want to say thank you to everyone who I saw and met in Boston. That was so much fun to be at WBUR, and thank you to WBUR for the awesome podcast festival, and met some great friends. Holy cow, the people from The Big Fib were awesome too. I really liked that show. So shout out to them. But shout out to everyone that I met. Thank you so much. It meant the world to me, and I had a blast. And I'm hoping to see you next year. Wink, wink, nod, nod. Think I'll be back. So make your plans. This episode is about two fun stories, two fun themes, subjects, cheese and donuts, both of which I like a lot. At the end, stick around and I'll tell you a fun donut story that I have to share with you, something that me and my friends do. Anyway, let's not put this off any longer. Party on. Historically speaking, being mayor of Nottingham in England has come with some strange hazards. Yes, it's the legendary home of outlaw Robin Hood, who stole from the rich and gave to the poor as he struggled with his nemesis, the Sheriff of Nottingham, but a few of the town's mayors have had to deal with their own peculiar challenges. Instead of dodging arrows from a legendary man in green, they were more concerned with dodging wheels of cheese. I'm not talking about little wheels of brie or Colby rounds that you might grab at the grocery store and tote home with little effort in a shopping bag. I'm talking about massive cheese wheels, so bulky that if they bounced into a bull, they'd leave the bovine with a bruise as big as a bookshelf. Some of these wheels are actually called truckles. That's the term for a cheese wheel that is taller than it is wide. Imagine a large barrel. Now imagine it's made of cheese. Now, imagine you're really, really, really hungry. Doesn't that cheese sound good? Now imagine you can't have it, and you're so hungry that a fit of anger compels you to roll it at the mayor of your town. If you hit that civic leader, well, that hefty hunk of circular cheese might send them to the hospital. Getting trucked by a truckle of cheese is a potentially deadly, but deliciously strange thing to happen. Luckily for Nottingham's Lord Mayor Mohammed Saghir, the cheese rolled at him in 2016 was in celebration, or at least in remembrance of an event that happened in Nottingham 250 years prior, the Cheese Riots of 1766. Mohammed Saghir was never really in much danger. It was a different story for the Lord Mayor of Nottingham back in 1766. And legend has it that this poor dude was like a human bowling pin bowled over by a cheese bowling ball. I guess more accurately, to repeat it, he was trucked by a truckle. Ah, the Goose Fair. Like many fairs of the past, the air around Nottingham's Goose Fair was filled with the delightful smells of livestock and cheese. For as long as anyone remembers, and certainly much longer before that, the Goose Fair has been bringing crowds to Nottingham. The official record states it began in the 1200s, but most likely it was a thing long before that. And the goose part of the Goose Fair is because it used to be where farmers from miles around would bring their crops, their livestock, and their other wares for trade. It was October, and people were going to need a lot of food to get them through the long English winter. So thousands of geese were marched from all directions into the fair for sale. And there were other things too, all sorts of crops, and of course, cheese. Gigantic, jumbo-sized wheels of it. And in 1766, people, all of whom had been Goosefest regulars for most of their lives, showed up to the October Fair with some expectations. And among those expectations was one that cheese prices would be similar to the price of cheese from years before. People of Nottingham thought the price of cheese would be stable. Were they right? They were worse than right. They were wrong. Now, it's important to understand that there were no grocery stores in 1766, and in a place like Nottingham, England, you had to plan well when it came to feeding your family for a winter season. Most people had limited budget, and what they didn't grow or raise for themselves, they needed to trade or purchase. And without the grocery store, one had to buy things at these festivals and fairs, sort of like an old-time farmer's market. But instead of a loaf of artisanal bread, a dozen farm-fresh eggs, and a cup of local coffee, people had to buy in large quantities, hence the truck-tire-sized wheels of cheese and flocks of geese. There are some other things about 1766 that you should know. First and foremost, it was a lousy year for crops, not just in Nottingham and not just in England, but all over Europe. And the lack of decent crops would become a problem for millions of people all over the continent. So people weren't exactly in a sharing mood. And you might ask, well, if England is short on food, certainly they wouldn't expect anyone to share, but what about buying more food? That's how supply and demand works, right? Couldn't people in England buy from somewhere else? Certainly someone was looking to make a buck. Well, that's the other part of what you should know. This is just after the Seven Years' War, which was a series of wars spanning both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, including the French and Indian War and the Anglo-Spanish War. It basically pitted Great Britain against everyone else. So, when England was in need of food, the rest of Europe wasn't really interested in helping them out. And when there's not very much food, the price of food goes up. And in Nottingham, there weren't many crops, but there still was a bunch of cheese. That was their thing. But the price of cheese went up a lot too. Over double the price of what it was the year before. So imagine the feelings people must have felt, the cheeseless anger that rose up inside them. So yeah, the first problem was that the cheese cost way more than it ever had. The second problem that soon developed was that food shortages weren't just an issue in Nottingham, as we've already learned. So merchants from other towns, knowing that Nottingham farmers were sitting on some big cheese, came to buy it and take it back to their town, where they'd mark it up for more money and sell it to their clientele. This did not make the folks of Nottingham very happy at all.
Nuh-uh. That's our cheese.
I purchased it fair and square. It's my cheese. You couldn't even afford it.
A group of men who have forever been remembered in the history books as rude lads began to surround some of the merchants, and before long, a struggle began. In other parts of the Goose Fair, more rude lads got between the truckles of cheese and the out-of-towners hoping to take it away.
Some real nice cheese you got there. Be a shame if something happened to it.
Something happened to it? Is that a threat? What could happen to it?
Well, two things. One, it could end up in my belly for a fair price. Or two, it'll go rolling down the streets, bound for who knows where.
Such a rude lad.
Yeah, I hear that's what they're calling us now.
Hello, Mr. Farmer. I'm here for my cheese. Here's a big stack of money. Wait, why are you rolling it down the street? You lads are being very rude.
Rude? Yep. Hungry and mad? Double yep. You, my friend, have a cheese riot on your hands.
Before long, cheese was everywhere. Rinds hurled through shop windows, truckles in every direction. It was curd chaos, a bedlam of brie. It was unpasteurized pandemonium. With the cheese flying this way and that, the mayor arrived on the scene to try to settle everyone down. But it was too late. The cheese riot was in full effect. It is said that one particular truckle of cheese knocked him on his rear as he attempted a bit of dairy diplomacy. But it was hopeless. One of the out-of-town cheese merchants was able to sneak to the river with a wagon load of cheese wheels. In a haste, he waved a small fortune in the face of a boatman to take he and his cheese elsewhere. Anywhere. Together they loaded the vessel, and as they worked their way through the load, they heard a posse approach.
Egad, it's the Rude Lads!
Where are you going with that cheese?
Nowhere.
Then what's it doing on the boat?
Just thought we'd take it for a ride.
A cheese ride? I don't think so. And anyway, your boat captain just ran off and left you. So you're toast.
Say, you guys don't seem so rude. You seem like nice lads, actually. How's about I sell you this cheese for the same price you paid last year? I'll take the loss. My treat.
We don't like Nottingham cheese leaving Nottingham.
Okay, I'll see myself out.
Okay, that's fine. Leave the cheese.
The cheese riots went on for days. And in many cases, it turned violent. The military was actually called in to put an end to a goose fair that had gotten out of control. Clearly, people were very angry about food from their town being sold for prices they couldn't afford to people from other towns who could afford it. I would never condone violence personally, but I would condone fairly priced cheese. So it's easy to see their point, but still not be on board with their cheese-rolling, mayor-squishing methods. Speaking of rolling cheese, injuries, and England, there is another annual event tangentially related, and it's one of my favorites. About 100 miles away, the Cooper's Hill Cheese Rolling and Wake brings hundreds to the English countryside each year. Most watch, and the fearless participate. If you don't know what it is, a group of people wait at the very top of a steep hill until a wheel of double Gloucester cheese is let loose to roll down the hill at a greater and greater speed. At once, the chasers speed down the hill after it, often tumbling head over tail, ducking and cannonballing and flipping and sliding their way all to the bottom. The person who catches the wheel is the winner. It is absolutely bananas. And to give you an idea of how dangerous it is, the organizers just go ahead and have ambulance crews and medics waiting at the bottom. People are going to need them. They do every year. It's typically every May, and this year in 2024, it will be on May 27th. So keep your eyes peeled for press coverage. But don't get any big ideas. I don't think anyone listening should go chase the cheese. Luckily for those of us who do like cheese, there is plenty of it available. You don't have to chase it. You can find it pretty much anywhere you'd think to look, and usually for a fair price. Hey, grown-ups. My family is always very happy when there is a Green Chef box on our front porch. It is the number one meal kit for eating well. Did you know that Green Chef is owned by HelloFresh? I did. Green Chef delivers everything you need to make convenient, wholesome, and delicious meals directly to your doorstep. Each meal kit includes pre-measured ingredients, some produce pre-chopped, and custom sauces pre-made in-house. Green Chef also sends organic fresh produce in every box along with responsibly sourced proteins including 100% sustainably sourced seafood and 100% antibiotic and hormone-free chicken. It's handy, it's easy, it's delicious, and it saves us a whole lot of time. Not to mention, saves us from the agony of having to decide what's for dinner. We've tried dozens of recipes so far and have really, really, truly enjoyed them all. There is some delicious food to be eaten. So take back some time in the kitchen with dinner in 30 minutes. Go to greenchef.com/curious50 and use code curious50 to get 50% off plus 20% off your next 2 months. One more time. That's greenchef.com/curious50. Use the code CURIOUS50 to get 50% off plus 20% off of your next 2 months. Grown-ups, gronies, grony balonies, this is for you. We've tried a lot of children's vitamins in my house, and very recently we tried Hiya brand. And I'd like to tell you about them because we like them a whole lot. While most children's vitamins are filled with like 5 grams of sugar, Hiya is made with zero sugar and zero gummy junk, yet it tastes great and is perfect for picky eaters, and I've got one of those. Hiya has been formulated with the help of nutritional experts and pressed with a blend of 12 organic fruits and veggies, and then supercharged with vitamins and minerals like vitamin D, B12, zinc, vitamin C, folate, and a whole bunch of others that help with immunity, energy, brain function, mood, concentration, you name it. And the first shipment comes with a really cool reusable bottle. My kids really got a kick out of decorating it with the included stickers. It looks great. My kids are sticker decorating geniuses. Anyway, after your first order, they'll send you eco-friendly refill packets from then on. We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamins, so receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, you must go to hiyahealth.com/curious. This deal is not available on their regular website. So go to hiyahealth.com/curious. hiyahealth.com/curious to get your kids the full body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults. Well, all right, now it's time for You Have 30 Seconds, and this month, Sylvie Pernas has a good one for us. Take it away.
Hey, Mick. My name is Sylvie, and I'm going to tell you about Valerie Jane Morris Goodall. Valerie Jane Morris Goodall is a primatologist who was born on April 3rd in 1934 in London, England. As a child, she dreamed of working with animals in Africa. Jane saved up for her goal and was soon on a boat to Tanzania in 1960. Jane lived with the chimpanzees for 30 years while studying their behavior. It has been more than 60 or so years, and Jane is still alive and is involved in many conservation projects. I love your podcast. Bye!
Oh, thanks, Sylvie, and great work. That was really well put together. Really well, really, you did a great job delivering it, way better than I was able to say it, blah, 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 right? No, you were very clear. I was not. Hats off to you. If you have a, you have a, you have a, you have a, you have a 30 seconds, you can send it to hello@thepastandthecurious.com. Just a voice memo message will do. It's all you need. Love it. Thank you very much. Thanks again, Sylvie. I wonder what time it is.
It's quiz time. It's quiz time. It's quiz time. Time, time.
Yes, it is quiz time. I've got two questions about cheese and one about donuts. So the first question that I have for you is, which state in America is responsible for producing the most cheese? This one's kind of easy. Surprise! It's Wisconsin. Just kidding. Wisconsin is, of course, the answer. Wisconsin's like super famous for making cheese. But I found it interesting to learn that the second place state is California. Okay, question number two. Below the ground, somewhere in America, limestone caves that are kept at 36 degrees have kept America's cheese surplus safe. Hundreds of thousands of pounds of cheese. And what state are these cheese caves in? No, it's not Wisconsin, and it's not California, but it is, in fact, Missouri, near Springfield, actually. It began when there was a cheese shortage in the 1970s. Ooh, that's scary. That resulted in skyrocketing cheese prices. That sounds familiar. But instead of dodging cheeses from angry crowds, the American government boosted production by putting money into the dairy industry, which lowered prices, but also meant they made more cheese than they actually needed. Waste not, want not. So currently, there is lots of cheese underground for preservation and to be used when needed. Okay, now it's time for your third and final question. Which city in America has the most donut shops per person? Hello, Boston! I love ya. And congrats, by the metrics I found, you have one donut shop for every 2,480 people. And I guess it makes sense when you hear the story that we're going to be telling in just a moment. I was just in Boston, and I didn't eat any donuts. What was I thinking? Quincy, Massachusetts is only about 11 miles south of Boston, which means it's a suburb of that big American city today. Once upon a time, though, Quincy was a town miles away from Boston, just like many other cities along the East Coast. Quincy does have the unique claim, however, of producing two American presidents, John Adams and his son, John Quincy Adams. Also in Quincy is a graveyard, the Snug Harbor Sailors Cemetery. And in that cemetery is a headstone that was replaced in 1982 after being missing for who knows how long. And if you ever happen by for a visit to that headstone, you might want to take a few donuts along with you. You wouldn't be the first. I have seen pictures of plenty of people eating a donut over the grave of Captain Hanson Crockett Gregory. Captain Gregory's true impact on the world is shrouded in mystery, but he has been called the inventor of the donut. Now that's a hard title to claim. There's actually evidence of donut-like foods going back centuries and centuries, and in cultures all over the world. If Captain Gregory has a claim on anything, and it's still up for debate, it's probably more of what he left out of the donut. You see, maybe, just maybe, he's the reason that we have a hole in the middle of our donuts today. But even that is tricky to nail down. Ancient Rome, Asia, Native America, all of these are places and cultures that may have had something like a donut on their menus at one time or another. But many of the people who explore the history of food today zero in on some Dutch bakers in New York City. Once upon a time, in the 1600s, the Dutch were the most powerful colonists in New York City, which was actually called New Amsterdam at the time. When England took over and called it New York, many Dutch remained, and many more arrived over the years. At some point, a food that they called oliekoeks started to find their way into people's mouths. Oliekoeks, in Dutch, is very close to its English translation, oily cakes. It doesn't sound terribly appetizing, I know, but supposedly they were made of leftover dough that bakers may have had from other jobs, and the dough would just be fried in hot oil or lard, and enjoyed maybe with honey or sugar. So, you know, kind of close to a donut, but definitely more lump-like in shape. And maybe it's something like this that wound up on Captain Gregory's ship in the mid-1800s. There are a bunch of stories about the captain's connection to donut lore. So let's start with the most popular one. It was 1847, and Captain Gregory was at the helm of a ship at sea. And late one evening, he was enjoying one of his favorite snacks, a big old oliekoek, while he was steering the ship with the pilot's wheel. Surely you've seen something like it, a large wooden wheel with spokes and handles radiating from the center. And these outer handles are how someone steering the ship would turn the wheel, which was much larger than the steering wheel of the family car. Well, according to the story, Captain Gregory was having a pretty breezy evening munching on oliekoeks with one hand and steering the ship with the other. At least until things went from breezy to queasy in the blink of an eye. When a strong, stormy squall seized the ship, snack time was spent. Dangerous waves and wild winds threatened the vessel. But still, he didn't want to toss the tasty treat overboard, or else lose it in the fierce wind and rocking waves. But he needed two hands on the wheel. It was a real dough dilemma. And looking at the handles on the wheel, he saw the solution. He slammed the round dough treat onto one of those handles, which poked a hole in the dough and kept it safe and nearby. Maybe every time he turned the wheel, he'd take a bite as it passed his face. It's hard to imagine a more dramatic creation story for the donut. Oh, Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack, and the prize we sought is won. The dough is done, frosted fun, and no one's empty-handed, and we all rejoice with the taste and where the hole has landed. Apologies to Walt Whitman, you know, the guy from episode 86. This is all really funny to think about, but there are some clear problems with this story. First, those wooden pilot wheel handles are pretty big, and they typically flare at the top. So, unless his oily cake was super-duper jumbo-sized, it certainly would have been obliterated when it slammed down onto the handle. More troublesome to the storyline is the fact that Hanson Gregory was born in 1831, and everyone seems to agree that the idea of a donut came around 1847, even the man himself, which means he would have been 16 years old at that time, and he most certainly was not the captain of a ship at the age of 16. Another more believable story says his mom didn't want he and his little seafaring friends to go hungry out there on the ship, so she baked holeless donut treats for the entire crew. And they loved most of these donuts, but everyone hated the center. This is because when cooking in the hot oil or lard, the dough in the center would not reach the same internal temperature as the sides. So while the outer circle part of the dough would get bready and donutty delicious, the center would remain uncooked dough. And that's not good eats. Captain Gregory actually claimed at one time that the heavy raw dough was not good for swimming. And swimming is an essential skill for a man at sea.
Help, I've fallen overboard, and I can't swim.
You can't swim? I've seen you swim. What's going on?
I mean, I can't swim right now. I've eaten too many donuts. And all that uncooked middle dough feels like lead in my belly. I'm afraid I'm going to sink. Help!
Very well. Someone throw him that life buoy, which looks kind of like... Hey.
Now, don't get me wrong. It wasn't the round hole of a life buoy that would lead to the donut's shape. But in this second story, the hole came from the goal of saving money. So hearing the complaints, Captain Gregory's mother tried to solve the gooey uncooked donut center by putting things like hazelnuts, which didn't require cooking, in the center to displace the dough. That way, you'd eat all the cooked dough, and then there'd be a little nutty surprise for you hiding inside instead of the uncooked gooey dough. Ugh. Some people will even tell you this is why they are called donuts, because they were dough with nuts in the center. But I'm not one of those people. So in this story, Gregory thought that these nut-filled donuts were good, but too expensive because of the additional cost of the nuts. So he suggested leaving the middle out entirely, just to save money. In 1916, an elderly Captain Gregory, now with a lifetime at sea, well behind him, was interviewed in Quincy, Massachusetts. And to many, this third version of the story that he told solidified his claim as the pioneer in donuts with holes. And it had nothing to do with pilots' wheels or saving money on nuts. And instead, it had everything to do with digestion. Now, while the other dialogue in this episode is dramatized and fictitious, what follows are Captain Gregory's words as they appeared in the Washington Post.
Now, in them days, we used to cut the donuts into diamond shapes and also into long strips bent in half and then twisted. I don't think we called them donuts then. They were just fried cakes and twisters. Well, sir, they used to fry all right around the edges, but when you had the edges done, the inside was all raw dough. And the twisters, they used to sop up all the grease just where they was bent, and they were tough on digestion. Well, I says to myself, why wouldn't a space inside solve the difficulty? I thought at first I'd take one of the strips and roll it around. Then I got an inspiration. A great inspiration. I took the cover off the ship's tin pepper box, and I cut into the middle of that donut the first hole ever seen by mortal eyes. Well, sir, them donuts was the finest I ever tasted. No more indigestion, no more greasy sinkers, but just well-done, fried-through donuts.
Less indigestion made for more productive sailors, and a more enjoyable dining experience all around. By the time of the American Civil War, round donuts with holes became fairly common. But they wouldn't be a major part of history until another war. In 1917, the year after Captain Gregory's interview, America sent troops to Europe as World War I raged. The Salvation Army sent support to the places American soldiers were stationed on the battlefront. This support included teams of women known as the Donut Lassies. Supplied with the ingredients and basic necessities to cook, they kept spirits up with thousands of donuts. They often made 9,000 donuts each day for the so-called American doughboys to eat. Upon the end of the Great War, and with much thanks to the returning donut enthusiasts, donut fever grew. In 1920, a Russian immigrant in America named Adolf Levitt invented the first donut-making machine, which would eventually make him a millionaire. This machine would, of course, lead to the rise of donut shops all over the country. There were independent shops, as there still are today, and then there came chains. First, Krispy Kreme, founded by a Kentuckian, and then Dunkin' Donuts. The first Dunkin' opened where else but in Quincy, Massachusetts, the final resting place of Mr. Donut Hole himself, Captain Hanson Gregory. And at some point, his headstone mysteriously disappeared. But years later, in 1982, a new one was created, and the founders of Dunkin' Donuts paid for it. It reads, Captain Hanson Gregory, recognized by the American Bakers Association as the inventor of the donut. It's pretty clear that he was not exactly that, but he was probably, in one way or another, the dude who put the hole in the donut that you see today. Well, okay, thank you for listening to this episode about cheese and donuts. And I think this is episode number 92, so we're just cranking through them. It's been a long road. Before I move on with the thank yous and I have a song, I promised you I'd tell you a little story about donuts, right? So a couple years ago, some friends and I were having a discussion and it turned into a disagreement over who had the best donut in our town. There's a lot of independent and chain donut bakeries, or there were more chains at the time. We couldn't agree on who made the best donut, so we decided to settle it scientifically. We started an event called the Donut Challenge, and we have done it every year, probably for about 10 years now. It's probably getting close to 10 years. So now it's turned into this family thing that we all do. And what we do is we pick six bakeries, and from each six, we get plain donuts, like glazed, we get chocolate donuts, and then we get dealer's choice, right? So then we cut them into bite sizes, judge who's impartial. We'll cut them into bite sizes. So we have just a table full of donuts. And everyone tastes all of the three varieties from six bakeries. When you add it all up together, it equals about three donuts. It sounds like a lot, but that's how it works. And then what we do is we score them. And then those scores are compiled and averaged. And then we award a prize for best glazed donut, best chocolate donut, best dealer's choice donut. Again, that's the baker's choice. And then the best overall bakery. And it is so much fun. Our families look forward to it every year. It's a nice, Saturday morning. We get together, it's kind of a brunch. There'll be fruit salad and all sorts of other things. But it's really about the donuts, the donut challenge. So it's a big fun thing. We started it. But hey, if you want to give it a shot where you live, you got some nice bakeries and you're not sure who is the best, it's a great reason to get people together. And eat some donuts, and hang out. It's a lot of fun. We'll actually be doing ours this year on June 1st. Our date moves a lot. But if you want to join in on June 1st, wherever you are in the world, then hey, let me know that you're doing a donut challenge of your own. That would be super cool. Okay, on with the thank yous. Catherine Rose Good Newber in Ohio. Hello to you, and thank you for enjoying the show. I'm so glad that you are out there listening. I hope this episode makes you happy. I hope every episode makes you happy. But thank you for your support, Catherine Rose. And I have another person to thank, and that would be Cora Alonzo out in sunny California. Cora Alonzo, how does it feel to be living in the number two cheese-producing state in the United States? I bet it feels good. Cora, Catherine Rose, thank you so much. And that's not all. I have a special birthday song for Wesley, who just turned 9 this month. I believe from Massachusetts. Didn't we meet at the WBR Festival, Wesley? Yeah, didn't let you in on this. But got you a little song. Heard you were named after an album that I like, so I kind of mimicked that album a little bit. And, well, here we go. Happy birthday, Wesley. Wesley Harding Del Carpini was skiing really fast. Over the snow you'd watch him go, but don't blink or he's past. He plays the drums, he has two thumbs, and if you give him some numbers, he's gonna give you a sum. That's just the way he is, doing cool stuff just like this. And so Wesley Harding Del Carpini goes flying by fast. Don't blink your eyes or you'll miss him when he goes past.
We've all been there. You're standing in a museum staring at a painting and all you can think is, I don't get it. To me, knowing the story behind an artwork is a huge part of knowing how to look at it. I'm Amanda, the host of the Art of History podcast, where we view history through the lens of some really great works of art. Each episode, we dive deep into the bigger picture behind some familiar and maybe not so familiar pieces. Check out Art of History now wherever you get your podcasts.